You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
About 380,000 babies are born significantly before their due dates every year in the United States. It's an experience no parent would wish on anyone, even though today doctors can perform medical miracles on preemies that never had a chance of survival even a decade ago. But the technological developments have leaped ahead of the need to communicate to worried parents what's going on, the consequences that early delivery may produce in a child later in life. These are difficult conversations about even more difficult life and death decisions that Jenny Gold, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, says are not being handled well in many cases. Gold says the NICU is a brave new world of early childhood development that good old-fashioned communication has not caught up with yet.
Most kids who go to the NICU do fine. A lot of these kids are slightly premature, or maybe they have fluid in their lungs. Technology has come so far that, you know, a lot of them really are able to make it and lead pretty normal lives. We're talking here about a small subset of babies who end up there who are really likely to have poor outcomes, either not making it or making it but surviving with severe disabilities.
How are decisions made in a neonatal intensive care unit situation? To continue with the care, to end care? How is the outcome evaluated as to whether this is going to be a so-called normal baby or not?
It's so hard to make those decisions because the outcome is really unknown. For example, if you save a baby at 24 weeks gestation, which is pretty early, some of those babies go on to do just fine, about 30% of them. But the rest of them who survive end up with severe disabilities. It's really hard to know which baby is going to be which. And you can give parents sort of all the statistics you want, but there's an incredible human capacity to hope that your baby is going to be the one that does okay. And end-of-life decision-making for babies is really different than it is for adults. You know, in the last few years in this country, we've had a rigorous conversation about end-of-life care for adults.
So it should be based on what we think the patient would have wanted. I mean, some folks say, what if grandpa could wake up and for 15 minutes he was completely lucid and we could explain to him exactly what's going on and he told us what he wanted us to do? What do we think he would say? But substituted judgment works only for people who have at one point been competent to make decisions. So in the case of small children, in the case of babies, substituted judgment is not really an option.
It's not an option, but it's also unavoidable in a sense. Who is that speaking?
So that's Dr. Mark Mercurio, and he is chief of neonatal perinatal medicine at Yale New Haven Hospital. What he's basically saying there is that for adults, there's the opportunity to sort of imagine what that adult wants. Well, that's just not possible for babies. We don't know what a baby would want. So it comes down to what the family and the parent wants. Their job is to sort of project forward. What would they want for their child? What do they think a good quality of life would be? But it becomes a larger and larger circle. So it's not just what's good for the baby, but it's also what's good for the family. Are there other children? Are there other children with special needs? What can this family handle? Religious beliefs come into the picture. Concerns about divorce, concerns about finances. All of these things enter the picture. It's a much more complicated circle of decision making.
And it would require that the level of communication, the awareness on all sides would be at the absolute top level. But that's really, really hard to know. And here's David Magnus, who's a doctor and director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
If you have a conversation, you may think you're doing a really great job of communicating and have a good conversation, but the only way to really know is to really collect the data. And it's something that we really don't do. If you think about it, when you get on the phone to talk to almost anybody, you hear this call may be recorded for quality improvement purposes. But we don't do that routinely for informed consent processes, right? We don't do that for patient communication. We could, and when studies are done to do that, they all find the same thing, which is it's pretty bad.
And what he means when he says informed consent processes, what he means is he's asking doctors are checking with parents what they want to do going forward. Do they want to take the next step? Do they want to do the heart surgery? Do they want to continue intensive care when things aren't looking good. Those are all steps along the way when decisions have to be made. And in for each of those decisions, the doctor really has to explain to the parent, what are all of the options and what does that parent want? It's so complicated for anyone to understand, especially in a time when you're just in a state of shock and real grief that the outcome for your newborn baby and all of the hopes that you have for your child may not come true. So what Dr. Magnus is saying there is we don't know how good doctors are doing at having these conversations. They're really difficult. And what we do know is that in general, they don't necessarily tend to be great at it. It's not something that is necessarily taught in medical school. It's not a real focus. Though I will say that is starting to change. They are starting to teach more of that.
In this particular case with these babies, the language, it seems, almost fails us as well. Here's Deirdre Miller, who's a nurse at Oregon Health Sciences University Hospital in Portland, Oregon.
When we sit down at family meetings, if an infant is going to be maybe developmentally or physically delayed, we use that word, delayed. And we think that everybody has a very clear understanding of what delayed means. And then we had a family who we use those words for, and later when it was just me and the mom in the room, she was like, well, the nice thing about being delayed is that it's like a train. The train will show up eventually. It's just going to be late. That's not how we use that word.
Absolutely. I mean, these conversations are so hard, and I think it's hard for doctors to sort of even want to say exactly what's possible. Delayed is a total euphemism. It's not necessarily telling a parent what's actually going to happen. And again, parents hear what they want to hear, and what they want to hear is your baby's going to be okay. But you hear from this nurse, Deirdre Miller, that there's all these miscommunications that happen, and if a parent is making decisions based on those misunderstandings, I mean, that's really an issue. And, you know, it's a complicated issue, right? I mean, basically, you're asking a parent to decide on some level what kind of risk of disability they're willing to accept. And that's a really hard question. And ethically, it's a difficult question as well. I mean, one really positive thing hospitals have started to do is have parents trying to make these decisions go and talk to other parents who have children with disabilities that may look like what their kids have. And that at least allows them to get some semblance of an idea of what this all means.
Jenny Gold is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Even when it's not life-threatening, parents with babies in the neonatal intensive care unit experience stress that can last a lifetime. Kate Hopper's older daughter, Stella, was born prematurely back in 2003. Kate, the author of Ready for Air, A Journey Through Premature Motherhood, now volunteers in the NICU, helping parents who are making tough decisions about their baby's health and future.
We were so lucky that Stella was 32 weeks, so she was just, you know, 8 weeks early, which sounds odd to say because it was still such a hard thing for us. She was only 3 pounds, but it was very much a sense of, like, they don't know what's going to happen. There was a sense that you don't ask, really, you know, how is she going to be okay? There was only one point after I found out that Stella had a small brain bleed. I said to the doctor, like, what does this mean? Like, I was so, like, I need to know what this means for my kid down the line. And she was kind of, you know, well, you know, she'll probably be fine. But if she's in grade school and has some math processing problems, like, get it checked out. And that sense that the nurses always say, how is she? They say, she's having a good day. Because they knew better than I knew at the time that in the NICU, anything can happen.
When you think back now, do you think you had the decisions sort of pre-thought through on some of the outcomes that could have happened? Nowadays, they're much more careful, it seems, maybe not careful enough based on some reporting, though, to have things spelled out a little bit so that if you go down a particular road, everybody knows what page we're on. Did you feel as though there were some scenarios that you, in fact, had no idea, and if you were to do it again, you would have a much clearer sense, what decision would be made?
I mean, I had no idea, you know, and especially because I was sick. I developed severe preeclampsia. So those first couple days of her life, too, I was in the hospital and I was very ill. And so I felt like I was coming out of a fog into this totally different world, and one for which I was not at all prepared. And we didn't really talk about that, like, okay, if this happens, then we do this. And so I think that behind the scenes, all of that was kind of understood from the medical professionals, but we didn't entertain it. And actually, I probably couldn't emotionally go there at the time, because I was like the thought of contemplating her death. You know, I was actually trying to not love her. I'd fall in love with this child because I was so worried something would happen to her.
Oh,
and
for heaven's sakes. Seriously?
And not in a sort of conscious way. It was only when she did develop sepsis and I thought, she's going to die, that I realized, oh, my God, I've loved her all along. And she can't leave me now. Like, I've just realized this. I'm not going to hold back anymore. And so that was the moment that also this kind of maternal instinct kicked in for me.
How old is Stella?
Stella is 12 and a half, and she's awesome. She's great, great health, soccer player, loves math. You know, she's doing really well. We were very lucky.
Do you ever look at her when she's asleep in her bed and ask yourself a question, if there's anything in there?
Yeah, well, and I do all the time. And I wrote her this letter on her 10th birthday. And it was that for so many years, I looked at her and would see kind of that preemie, like on her birthday, I would revisit all of those, you know, at 6 a.m., this is what happened, at 7 a.m., this is what happened. And then when she turned 10, it wasn't like that anymore. It was replaced by different memories of her, you know, doing a double scissors or, you know, doing all of these different soccer moves and holding her little sister. And so that has faded for me, but it's still there. I mean, still when I go into the NICU and I see a 3-pound baby, it feels like I've just been punched. So the power of that experience, it really holds on to parents.
Kate Hopper is the mother of two and author of Ready for Air. Her daughter, Stella, is 12 and a half?
Yes, 12 and a half.
Kate, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.